The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have made a start. 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting from 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Tuesday, July 2nd evening space show program, evening here in California. I'm your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in. It is a sweltering hot night, those long hot nights in the summer, up in the space show studios on the second floor of this Petaluma mansion that I live in. And we're happy to do the show for you tonight. A couple of quick announcements for you. Hotel Mars does take place tomorrow, but of course it's pre-recorded, and then it will be posted as soon as John Batchelor uploads it, and I can get it onto the Space Show site. Due to the 4th of July holiday, there will be no show on Friday and no show on Sunday. We resume our regular programming on Tuesday of next week. And for tonight, I will explain why in just a minute, but we're looking at the 60-minute, one-hour format. So once again, if you want to call and talk to Dr. Jurist or email him or yell and scream at him or praise him, do it while we're still on the air. So pay attention to your clocks and watches, please. So our toll-free number for tonight, and again, toll-free is the predominant way we want to use in talking to our guest, 1-866-687-7223. And remember, the Space Show is a talk show, which primarily means we talk. But if all you do is send emails, we don't really get to talk, do we? So we want to talk. That means please use the telephone. And again, toll-free, 1-866-687-7223. For those of you that are hard-headed and absolutely refuse to use the telephone or technically for some reason cannot do so, email is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. Plus, you can post comments on our blog. To do that, go open the homepage, thespaceshow.com. All the way to the far right is the upcoming show menu. This is the first program listed. Open that page up, which is also our blog page. Scroll all the way to the bottom, and you'll see an area to post your comments. You can do so as a guest. You do not have to log in to anything. And as soon as you hit send, I'll get a copy of it and can bring it up on the Space Show while we're talking to Dr. Jurist. Again, the toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223. While you're at our website, thespaceshow.com, be sure you check out the website newsletter. It is current for the week, but the upcoming shows that are, if you scroll down, you'll see the list. They're current as of today, going into October and November, and the balance of the year. So we are booking shows at a very rapid rate, and we're just a little more than halfway through the year, and we're already booking into the last quarter of the year. And I don't know that that's ever happened before on the Space Show. You can call us again, 1-866-687-7223. Remember, everything that we do is archived, and you can download shows quickly or listen off of our website. There is a store for those of you who would like Space Show paraphernalia, logo wear. And again, the best way to access our store is to click on any of the website pages that have a picture of Pepper the Husky listening to the Space Show, and Pepper will take you directly to our Cafe Press store. Upper left menu has Listen Live. So remember, this tells you and others how to listen to live programs, how to listen to MP3 archives on our website, and also podcasts, including those by Alexa. Do also remember that we're a listener-supported, nonprofit 501c3 program. And because many of you do support us financially, we bring you great guests like we've been having lately. And I know they're great because I'm getting lots and lots of emails thanking me for them. Even the book authors, many of you are appreciative of hearing their stories about their books and what they have to say. So, but it doesn't all come for free. And your support is needed for the space show. And we certainly thank you. Those of you who do support us and those of you who will be supporting us, remember, if you're a U.S. federal taxpayer, you get a tax deduction for your gift. And if you're a California taxpayer, you also get a tax deduction for your gift. Our parent is OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. Check it out. You can also find out about becoming an advisory board member on the One Giant Leap website. If you have nonprofit, fundraising, tax deduction, or other questions, email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. There is a big PayPal button on the right side of our homepage, and this is for those of you who would like to contribute to us using PayPal. For those of you who want to do so by check in the U.S. mail, there are instructions for sending your check made payable to One Giant Leap Foundation and the P.O. Box to use for doing that. And we certainly appreciate your supporting us. And again, it is really necessary. We also have sponsorships, and those sponsors get the banner ad that you see going across our homepage. They can change that sponsorship banner ad as often as they like. And when we do the full-length programs, and again, tonight is a shorter program, I do read the full sponsor message from each sponsor. But because we're on the shorter format tonight, and I'll explain why in just a minute, I want to mention our sponsors, all of them, and we wouldn't be doing the show if it weren't for these great sponsors: Northrop Grumman, the Space Foundation, Moonwords, AIAA, the Space Development Network, Celestis, the National Space Society, and the Space Plan, the Integrated Space Plan. Without their great support, there would not be a space show program. If you're interested in being a sponsor, it runs on a 12-month basis. So if you signed up, say, for July, it would end in June of 2020. Email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And the reason we're doing the 60-minute format tonight, because I really thought we might do the 90-minute format, is because of the absolutely incredible service that our government has done about bringing rural cellular and internet service to rural America. And our guest lives in sort of modified rural Montana. He is sitting in his car on the top of a mountain about 20 minutes from where he lives, using his Verizon cell phone to do this show. That shows dedication, listeners. So we appreciate Dr. Juris doing that, but his voice is raspy, as is the connection. And they've just had a storm go through the Billings, Montana area. So we're doing 60 minutes for weather, for voice, for cell phone service, for rural internet. Let's all give three cheers to the members of Congress who have absolutely done a great job of bringing rural internet and cellular service to people across this country. John, welcome back to the Space Show. Regular listeners know of you because you're on all the time. But listeners, in case you don't know who we're talking about, Dr. Juris is a board member of One Giant Leap. He is also a physicist and a medical researcher, and then he turned to business. He has his degree in biophysics and nuclear medicine. He's got numerous, numerous papers written. He does a lot of consulting. He's a professor at Rocky Mountain in biophysics and many other topics. He's also was teaching as an adjunct at the University of North Dakota. His full bio is current. It is on our Space Show website page. We're very happy to have him back with us, sitting in his car on a mountaintop. Dedication to the Space Show. John, welcome back. How are you?
Well, thank you. I'm just fine and enjoying the view. It's a beautiful view out here in rural Montana.
What is the view? What are you looking at?
Right now I'm looking at a bunch of rolling hills and the Yellowstone River, which is, I believe, the longest undammed river in the United States.
Any cattle or horses running by?
Not here. I have a bunch of them at my residence, but not here.
Well, I know you're just really thrilled that your rural internet and cellular service is so great there from all the congressional promises, but we're not going to go down that road tonight. I know you would really like to thank your members of Congress for all they've done on that. But instead, for those of you that live in rural America, if you want to call in and comment on just how really, really horrible internet and cell phone service is in rural America, you're welcome to do that, even though that is not a topic for tonight's space show program. But I live it with Dr. Jurist all the time because we talk frequently. Anyway, probably the hottest topic on the space show overall, I mean, it can change from night to night, is we're going back to the moon. So there are people that believe we really are going back to the moon, and many believe we're really going to do it in 2024. And there are some that believe the Gateway is absolutely the way to go. It's a great program. And at ISDC, listening to Administrator Bridenstine and then Scott Pace a few days later, you know, they're either great actors and can tell a fib along with the best of them, or they really and truly believe we're going back to the moon. So listeners know I'm kind of skeptical for economic and other reasons. Let's start out with your take on going back to the moon. And if you can believe it or not, you already have a caller on hold.
I'm in trouble then.
You're in trouble. And the caller is none other than Mr. Moon Guy Engineer from the tractor in Oklahoma, Martin Marshall. Marshall Martin, if I get it right. So he's on hold. He can wait for a few minutes. Are we, in your opinion, headed back to the moon, and when?
Not in 2024. I think that there are far too many factors that will prevent the return of the United States to the moon by 2024. In the long term, I'm an optimist. I'm a strong believer in human spaceflight and its benefits for our society. But I don't think that we're going to be getting back to the moon by 2024.
So the long term, let's put a year on the long term. Another date they throw around a lot is 2028. Is that long enough term?
It would be physically possible if our leadership in the United States decided to make it a priority, but it's questionable that they would do so. You don't hear a lot of talk in Congress about going back to the moon, the excitement of human spaceflight, and so on. And I don't believe that celebrating the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11 in another couple of weeks is going to do more than provide a little temporary bump in public interest.
So if 2028 doesn't sound like in the future, how far out would your future clock go before you think it's a safe bet to say we're going to go to the moon?
My guess would be around 2040 or thereabouts.
Jesus Christ.
And I might also mention that I'm not sure that the humans on the moon at that time will be speaking English.
2040. I mean, that's 21 years or so. That's a long time. But we're supposed to be on Mars by 2040 or so.
We were supposed to be on Mars by 1984 in the late 60s, too.
So Mars, when do you see that happening, if at all?
I would put it at a couple of decades after the moon. And I believe a reason for that is related to the issues of human factors and long-term space flight.
Okay, so one of the things that I hear from many, many different guests and some callers, and I heard a lot of it at ISDC, by the way, when I would go into my economics and Congress and, you know, some of the things that you talked about, but in more detail, they would say, yeah, all of that's true, But this time it is different. And here's why it's different. We have a new private sector. We have the Falcon rockets, including the big rocket that's going to come about, but Falcon Heavy. We have Jeff Bezos and his big rocket. So we have a private sector that can do it and help lead the government sector. So it's different this time. It's not going to be purely government. It's going to be a public-private partnership. It's not going to be purely private either. And we have international participation, which will help defray some of the cost. It might take a little longer because of the political stuff back and forth on international negotiations. But so this time it's different because we've got Musk, Bezos, big rockets in the commercial sector, the Falcon family of which already work. Your take on the contribution and the speeding up of a possible timeline through the private sector?
Well, I think that's true in a sense. We do have the Falcon X, or the Falcon Heavy, if you want to call it that. We have Bezos and the like, so the private sector is plugging along. The idea of public-private partnerships sounds good. However, it complicates issues because now instead of one entity running everything in terms of a program, you have two entities that are not exactly co-equal trying to run things. That would be the private part of the partnership and the public part of the partnership. The public part is still hamstrung by the issues related to our political system and the lack of effective leadership and the temporary nature of our national leadership and going from one term to another. And that also seems to reverse things. So as a hypothetical situation, it may be that the next president says, no, we're not going to the moon, and it's a dead deal for 2024. So to me, it's a very iffy situation. And that's not even considering some of the human factors issues, because if we're going to go to the moon and establish a permanent presence somewhat analogous to what we might have, let's say, in Antarctica for studying the moon, then we have to be sure that the human factors issues related to the reduced gravitational field are addressed satisfactorily. And other people would say, well, we've done that with a space station. And the answer to that is yes, to an extent we have, but not with a larger population or sample size of people who've experienced as much as a year in microgravity is very small. It's not easily enlarged, and nobody knows where the optimal gravitational level is in terms of the deleterious effects of microgravity no longer being an issue. Is it at 1/6 G for the moon, or 38% of G as on Mars, or is it a full G? Nobody really knows the answer to that.
Let's pause with you and me, and we'll now bring Marshall in and let him get his 2 cents in and his question. Marshall, are you still with us? Welcome back to the show.
Yeah.
How are you? Thanks for your patience.
I could not resist the call to comment on the remote out in the countryside cell phone service, because mine's very hit or miss.
Well, you're remote Oklahoma, not Montana.
Well, I do not have any mountains blocking my signal. True. Anyway, I have been looking at a group called the Gateway Foundation that wants to build the Von Braun space station, a very modular type system. And it would be a Stanford Taurus type that circles. And they have a very nice video out there, but you kind of go, gee, they talk about international participation and the government participation, you know, buying different modules. But I do think they have a key point, and that is you can't go to the moon until they have a significant time testing partial gravity.
What's the website for the Von Braun Foundation? Do you know it off?
Let me see if I can find it real quick.
Well, or we can look it up. Is it just called the Von Braun Foundation?
Well, it's called the Von Braun Station. It's called the Gateway Foundation.
The Gateway Foundation, okay.
Yeah.
Not
and,
to... Okay.
And it was... They have a very nice video, but like a lot of things, a nice video does not cover... glosses all over all the really key... things that you need to make sure get done that, you know, hasn't been. And, you know, obviously building a rather large space station is a huge project. And let's face it, the International Space Station barely passed to, you know, get funded by Congress. So
is that needed to go to the moon? Is that what they're saying?
Yes. And I kind of agree with them. We have to have, you know, people going into space stay at one-third gravity probably for like 2 years, and Mars gravity, one-third gravity probably for 2 years before we really build colonies and stations on either location. I'm just wondering if John agreed.
Basically, I do, particularly for any type of permanent habitation or colonization. It might be different if you have a permanent human presence, but you rotate people in and out. For example, with 6 month or 1 year tours on the moon, that is a lot different from somebody going to the moon and living there, and specifically, it's a lot different than going to the moon, living there, and trying to raise a family. That has a whole host of other implications, including ethical implications in raising children in a very hostile environment.
Mm-hmm. I agree. You don't really have any kind of accomplishment until there's children involved.
That's right.
That's not really even being proposed by anyone near term.
You can go talk to people and children in space, oh my God, that's terrible content. No, it's a requirement.
But at what point is it a requirement, Marshall? 10 years later, after the first people sit down in a colony, 20 years later, one day later, what's the requirement? You're saying it's a requirement. What's the spec for that requirement? You're an engineer. Give me the spec for that.
That assumes that a algebra-based computer geek can come in there and predict women. Sorry, impossible task. I do know that guys aren't going to really stay on station unless they have wives. And wives won't stay very long if they don't have children. So,
I don't know about that. A lot of people are opting not to have children. I mean, I don't know that you could make a blanket statement like that. And by the way, Siri is a computer geek, and she's an English girl for me. So, I mean, I don't understand what you're saying there.
Well, I guess I'm just very pro-family and pro-colony. So...
So can't you have a colony without the need to have children? And couldn't that be a self-sustaining colony for 10 or 20 years or 30 years? Why do children on a colony have to be rushed? Why can't you develop the colony, make it economically and technically self-sustaining, and let it develop some kind of track record of doing A, B, C, and D, and maybe even making a profit, before thinking about how you would deal with family, school, children growing up, things like that?
Mm. Well, you got a good point, I get the feeling it's the same problem we have about just going there and, putting a footprint on the moon, we can always put it off till next year. Let's do this other project first. Let's do this other project first. And it never gets done.
John, do you want to offer comments? Do children have to be on the settlement quickly, or could they be a decade or two later?
Well, it depends on how you want to structure the settlement and what its purpose is. If your purpose is to have a self-sustaining colony or entity, then you're going to have children eventually. And eventually might mean in a decade or something, but I suspect that people being people, if they're together and living in cramped quarters, things happen, and you may end up with children far earlier than you expect. Now, that brings up another issue. Nobody really knows whether a woman can carry a fetus to term in reduced gravity, whether it be Martian gravity, lunar gravity, or microgravity in a some big space station situation.
So what do you do that by, on-the-job training, or is there actually research lab experiments that could determine that?
I expect that there have already been some experiments related to fertilization of ova and things like that, perhaps even with small mammals. I'm not familiar with that research, but it wouldn't surprise me if that's already been done on the space station in terms of fertilization. But in terms of actually bringing a mammal to term is indicative of what might be the case with humans, but you have to remove the element of risk. And from what I remember of my embryology course over half a century ago, gravity is important in some of the earlier stages of embryogenesis.
Yeah, and another reason that they need a Stanford Torus artificial gravity space station.
You get no argument from me on that one.
Has Congress considered funding that, Marshall?
Not to my knowledge. Absolutely nothing. The only thing they've funded that has the word gateway associated is the Lunar Gateway, and not too many people support that one.
So here's what I don't understand, and John, I've asked you this a million and a half times during private phone calls, and I've probably said it fewer times on the show, but sure. The people advocating colonies, O'Neill colonies, going to the moon to stay, going to Mars to stay, Zubrin. I mean, we can go through a whole list. A lot of them have been on the show, but there's 10,000 more that have never been on the show and that I don't even know. But they advocate and they make a good case and they articulate very, very well. And they're not dummies. They're smart people. But they don't address what Marshall and you are talking about right now. They don't address pregnancy, childbirth. What do you do with a child? Will he develop or she develop? None of this is developed. None of this is really discussed in their plans for going to the moon to stay with a settlement. It's just dismissed or skirted, or maybe they say, "Yeah, we got to do some research on it." It's avoided, in my opinion. And is it? Do you think it's avoided because it's a showstopper? Because remember, they all say there may be some problems with radiation or artificial gravity, but there's no showstoppers. There's no showstoppers. We can handle it. We can shield. We can spin. We can do tether. No showstoppers. But boy, are there a lot of challenges still to be resolved. Is it because the pregnancy and childbirth and fertilization and all of that are actual showstoppers, so let's not talk about it?
I don't think anybody really knows for sure, but I believe what happens is the people that are advocating those types of activities go back to the mental model of settling the West a couple of centuries ago here in the United States. And they have this idea of, you know, pioneer women riding along in their Conestoga wagons.
Right.
On their way west and having a kid on the way and eking out a living of some sort out in isolated areas and on and on and on. But that's not the same thing as as the situation that we'd be looking at with colonization in space, not only because space is a much more hostile environment than the American West was, and it was pretty hostile, I might mention, but also our ethical standards and our habits and laws and looking at risk are a lot different today than they were a century or two centuries ago. And I suspect that a lot of people that are advocating that, with the idea of, yeah, we can just plow ahead and we'll get it done when the time comes, don't really understand the time frame that's needed to answer some of the questions that can be raised about biology and reproductive biology in a space environment. And it's not just microgravity, by the way. Radiation is a big issue as well.
Marshall, do you want to add your two cents here, or do you have anything additional that you want to say before
we
go on?
I've already taken up quite a bit of time, and I'm happy to lead it off into what I find a very interesting direction, but I think it's time to let somebody else have fun.
Thank you, Marshall. Always great to have you on board having fun with us. We appreciate it. So,
bye-bye.
Thank you for calling.
Listeners, Marshall has gone back to the tractor, and the toll-free line is available, 1-866-687-7223. Let me get your opinion on something else. Congress continuing with SLS and Orion. So they did an Orion abort test, I guess it was last night, and they did it. They said they wanted to do it in a hurry, so they didn't bother to make any arrangements to recover the Orion. So it went up, it passed the abort test, it did what it was supposed to do, and it went plop into the Atlantic Ocean. And they're sitting someplace on the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean. So they didn't recover it to look at the systems, to do any analysis. Your take on the continuation of this federal program, SLS and Orion. Falcon Heavy is just a fraction of the cost and can do almost as much as SLS Block 1, but so much cheaper, and it's a proven rocket. You can't call Falcon Heavy a paper rocket or a PowerPoint rocket, SLS you can call that. Dragon has flown. It's got its problems, but it has flown. So your take on the government rocket?
Obviously, it's being continued for political reasons or political considerations. The main thing from my point of view as a taxpayer is the cost of the thing. It's enormously expensive. It continues, the developmental costs continue to climb. The talk is that the cost of flying the thing will be on the order of over $1 billion a flight for something that with the Block 1 would have about 10% more payload capacity than a Falcon Heavy exhibits now. That's assuming no growth potential with the Falcon Heavy. And then when you get to the Block 2 SLS, you're looking at twice as much payload capacity, let's say 280 or 290,000 pounds into low Earth orbit as the maximum capability of the Block 2 SLS. That is roughly the same, a little smaller, but roughly the same as the Saturn V from 50 years ago. And yet you're talking about billions and billions of dollars that have been sunk into this thing. Now, you've already mentioned you can compare it to the Falcon Heavy, where the development costs are done. I mean, the thing's flown, what is it, three times now?
Something like that,
and,
yeah.
And it can carry a payload that's similar, as I mentioned, to the SLS Block 1. So the trade-offs there are, is it better to do, say, two or three Falcon Heavy flights, assemble something at a space station in Earth orbit and then do whatever you want with it? Or is it better to develop a monster rocket that can carry everything up and do it all in one launch or two launches? And by the way, I don't believe it's possible with chemical rocket technology to send humans to and from Mars with the SLS in one launch. So to me, it's not cost effective anymore, and it's something that the concept has been bypassed by further developments, including in the private sector.
Well, Musk wants his big rocket, which is going to be bigger than the Saturn V, as I understand, and to take the humans
right.
to Mars. But of course, that's not it's not developed yet.
Right, and the other thing is that before the Saturn V, there was a concept for a bigger rocket that was Nova.
Right,
and the Nova was pretty much a non-starter for a variety of reasons, including the acoustic issues in launching it. In other words, it made so much noise that it was self-destructive, at least on paper. So that may be a problem that limits the ultimate size of rockets, and whether the BFR of SpaceX can get past those issues or not remains to be seen, but you're pushing awfully close to the limits of the Nova in terms of the Block 2 SLS.
Well, we don't hear
in terms of overall size.
We don't hear anything other than from you about acoustic challenges. I mean, nobody talks about that for the SpaceX rockets or for anything, not the SLS or anything.
Well, there were issues even with the shuttle system with potential acoustic damage. That's one of the reasons for flooding the launch pad with a lot of water in order to absorb some of the sound and reduce the reflection of sound back from the ground to the base of the rocket and at intensities that are high enough to damage the base of the rocket. And by the way, these things do get really loud. You know, in terms of decibel equivalence, just one of the five-segment boosters for the SLS generates somewhere in the approximate neighborhood of 200 decibels near the exit plane of the nozzle. That is really intense sound.
So in contrast, what is a typical semi-automatic 45 caliber, if you're the one firing it, what's the decibels that you would get as the bullet is fired?
Well, probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 140, 145 decibels. Remember, the decibel scale is a log scale.
Right.
And so you're doubling the sound intensity about every 3 decibels. And you know, a jet engine winding up might be 145 decibels, somewhere in that range. And so going from that to 200 decibels is a huge increase in sound intensity. You're talking about megawatts of sound.
So the interesting thing about that is, as you know, I'm planning on a backup generator system here because of the proposed PG&E week-long power outages for fire risks. So I've been investigating generators, and so the one I'm settling on is about 71 decibels measured at 25 feet from the generator, which is how they do it for a generator. So in talking to a company rep for another brand who said his generator was 75 decibels, and I said, well, I'm looking at one that's 71. He says, well, 75, not that much louder. You know, you probably couldn't tell a difference. And I said, I don't think so. That's a huge amount of sound difference. And he did not know how you calculate one decibel level to another or that it was a log scale. I thought that was pretty interesting that he's out selling this stuff and he doesn't even know how to talk about the sound levels of his product, but maybe that's standard, or maybe it's an advanced concept. I don't know. You're the one who taught it to me, so.
He should have have taken my class in elementary physics.
So 75 decibels is a lot different than 71, especially if you're in a residential neighborhood.
It's significantly different, let's put it that way, because you're doubling the sound intensity.
So
approximately.
So the elections are coming up. We're going to have some kind of an active campaign. You've got a space program and a moon program in place with a proposed cost estimate of maybe $30 billion over 5 years, something like that, to go to the moon. But it has to be an add-on to the existing NASA program, which is already getting more money than normal. Is it going to be a campaign issue? Will the Republicans fight to take us back to the moon and really drive it home as a campaign issue? Is it like a do-or-die campaign issue? Have we finally gotten to the point where we got to have a moon program? We've got to go back to the moon, or is it still a throwaway like it's been every year since we went to the moon?
Oh, I think it's very important that we return humans to the moon for a variety of reasons, but whether the political leadership in the United States really understands that, I'm not sure. If you look at history of the last couple of administrations, you recall that there was a proposal to go to Mars during the Bush 1 era.
Right.
And that got shot down almost immediately. Then
you had the vision for space exploration.
Yeah, the vision for space, that was reversed with the next change in administrations. Yeah, Constellation, that was reversed with the change in administrations, and so on and so forth. So somehow we need, as a society, to develop a way of having programs survive for longer than a term of office. And I don't know how that's done in the current political situation.
So you don't think you're going to see it rise as a do-or-die campaign issue, for example, this year?
I don't think so. There might be a little bump because of the upcoming 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 landing. But I don't see that being more than a temporary bump in public interest. And our leadership, our political leadership, seems to me to be more followership than leadership, in that they're driven by public opinion rather than driving public opinion.
You have another caller on hand. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you? Thank you for calling.
This is John of Fort Worth.
Hi there.
I was getting back to the earlier discussion on the moon. I mean, one thing is that obviously, I mean, it was almost like we're going straight to colonization, which is way, I think, out there. I mean, just even the mechanics of getting that kind of equipment and people on the moon is way above SLS, or, I mean, you'd almost be talking something like the BFR or some similar, maybe not quite as big rocket, you know, that would be reusable to actually logistically support a colony. So I think early on we're just talking about an exploration base, sort of, you know, people doing a six-month stint up there or something and getting replaced by another group or something like that.
Right.
Yeah, I mean that would be almost visionary compared to our current political leadership, as you say. Actually have that in operation. I mean,
are you optimistic that that's going to happen, John Hunt?
Not really. I mean, I'd like it to happen, but I really think it's... I don't think the next big advance will be if the Chinese ever can get their act together and really do something like get up there. Then that might stimulate us to react to it. Or if we thought they were on the verge of actually doing it. Right now, they keep talking about it, but I don't... Maybe I'm not too well aware of what the Chinese capabilities are, but I don't see they're anywhere close to doing a human moon mission, are they? I mean, in terms of rocketry and capsules?
Well, they put men in space, humans in space, so Could they get them to the moon? Probably not. They have a long timeline for that, remember? That they don't have any timeline like 2024 to do that. But they have put people, they're one of the countries that have put people in space.
Yes, well, I mean, yeah, and the U.S. and Russia accomplished that by 61, 62. So, I mean, I'm just saying, they're a little bit ahead of that, but I mean, they really aren't, I don't see them really moving very rapidly to that. I mean, that's why the Gateway, everybody wants to knock it, and I mean, it looks like that might be something we could do, I mean, potentially, I mean, if you don't do anything, the whole thing dies again. I mean, you got to get things flying. And
well, do you think that keeping the Gateway in place, that we're actually going to see the program happen, or do you think it's going to die anyway, regardless of the Gateway? I mean, it needs additional funding, so it needs to get congressional support.
Right. That's hard to know. I mean, the problem with the 2024 goal, as I see it, is it almost looks like it's, I mean, I'm not knocking anybody here, but it's so oriented toward the current administration's hope to have a second term and have that as a final crowning achievement or something. And with a split Congress, that almost makes it a political, you know, no way. Plus, technically, even if we were funding at whatever level we wanted to need it, I'm wondering if we'd really get there for that time anyhow. I mean, that's a pretty major impetus.
Well, let's add something else into the mix, and that's in the very short term. There have been widespread crop failures and some looming problems with food production in the United States because of the current spring weather and flooding in the Midwest, and you know, on and on and on. And that's a problem because it's going to be driving up the costs of food and other commodities that are related to agriculture, including, for example, ethanol production from corn that goes to, in one sense, to feed cattle. Another sense, it goes to making ethanol to stick in gasoline. Now, that sounds like it's kind of a local problem, except you mentioned the Chinese and what they're up to, and I know nothing about how their economy really works, but they're going to have some huge stresses within the next year or two also because of widespread crop failures in China, as well as a big problem right now with the swine flu going through their pig population. And that's going to get to the point where there's a very real risk of a lot of people starving on this planet in the next year or two. So how that's going to be handled and how that affects funding for a space program, I really don't know. But I suspect there may be some kind of a linkage there. And that brings up something else, David, that we've talked about privately. Right now, the national debt is in excess of $20 trillion.
Approaching 23 trillion.
20 trillion.
23
yeah,
trillion.
And if you take 1% of that, that's $230 billion a year. And so a 0.25% hike in interest rates by the Fed would be in excess of $50 billion a year additional interest. And that's roughly twice the annual budget of NASA right there. So if the feds end up boosting interest rates a quarter of a point, you've taken away discretionary spending equal to twice the NASA budget. And that's a big problem because there are some inflationary pressures on interest rates.
Well,
and they go up, they go down, obviously, and the government does have the ability to print money, and so that gets into something where our economist friends can opine more intelligently, but I just find that rather scary.
So the moon program is estimated at $30 billion. So let's double it because it's government work. Okay, so who knows what it'll really
sure.
cost? So $60 billion. So I've been talking about this for year for years, literally years. So when they increase the interest rate by one quarter of a point, you're going to have roughly $50 billion more of interest that is mandatory to be paid because to default on our interest payments would be pretty much the end of the economy of the United States, in my opinion.
Right.
I think that would be more of a fatal blow than a nuclear bomb landing off the coast of the West Coast someplace. It would be really, that would be it for us economically. And so that's probably what the moon program is actually going to cost, even going through the gateway, because I don't think they'll come in on budget or on a timeline for $30 billion. Again, I'm just using the number they're throwing out. So now, right now, the interest rates are stable, and they're talking about maybe they'll have to lower them because there's some signs of softness in the economy and inflation, kind of along the lines of what you're talking about with food and agriculture and some other weak areas. So what they do with the interest rate, and then you look at discretionary spending, is really something. So if the interest rate goes up and they continue spending the same way they're spending, so it's really a double hit because they're funding the interest by borrowing. So at some point, one would rationally think this has an effect, but then as Greg Autry and others have pointed out, and what my talk at the Griffith Observatory is going to be about on the 18th, is that the actual economic returns from the Apollo-era program, this includes Mercury, Gemini, all of it, were so phenomenal. They're around 14 to 15 to 1 on the econometric models of the day, which are questionable, but the reason they're questionable is because there were so many variables at that time in the 60s or early 70s. They didn't have a good way of dealing with all of the variables they had to add into the model. So that's why maybe there's some questions about the validity of some of the econometric models showing these really high returns. But there isn't any other government project or program that even comes close to what Apollo did. And at ISDC this year, I still met people that formed a business. Entrepreneurs, young people, millennials, have formed a business because they were inspired by the Apollo era, the moon period, by going to space. They're not inspired by shuttle. They're not inspired by the space station, not space in general, although some want to go into planetary science because of the planetary program. So there's a little bit on that side. But Apollo, our going to the moon, is still putting people in education and in jobs and spurring economic wealth and tax revenue for the government today, 50 years later. No other program does that. So we're talking about the detriments here, the negatives of the way we've been spending money like a drunken sailor over the years, what all this means, and yet the program that we're talking about is the only government program of record that has any kind of capability to produce phenomenal returns for decades and decades, even after the program is over with. So how can you turn your back on that because we have to borrow money?
That's why I'm an enthusiast for human spaceflight.
John Hunt?
Well, I mean, obviously we should go ahead, but I think one thing also is that at the time of Apollo, we were developing radically new technological advances to accomplish it. Whereas right now, we're sort of using off-the-shelf technologies to make marginal improvements to do what we're doing. I mean,
right.
I don't think it's quite the R&D push that was in the 60s.
No, I agree with you, but some parts of it are an R&D push, and of course, we don't know where it's going to take us. Certainly on life support, and the human factors that jurists has talked about earlier, there's going to be a big push on that technology development. And if we actually put families in there and kids and pregnancy and stuff like that, my hunch is there's going to be huge pushes on some of these issues or real motivational pushes on gravity, radiation, and other things, the likes of which we can't even imagine today without that kind of background push. But maybe also we'll finally move into nuclear propulsion or something different.
Yeah.
rather than chemical rockets, which you're right, were being developed and pushed back then, and now all we can do is make marginal improvements on chemical rockets.
Yeah, what I'm saying, basically, barring an absolute economic cataclysm, the U.S. government could, if it chose to, fund any reasonable space program we're talking about, 1, 2 to 3 times the level that we have now. The problem is simply the political decision and will to do so, which I think is lacking.
Well, and then to make the case for it. So I just briefly in 1 minute with John Juris made a case for borrowing the $30 or $60 billion, even though we see how much the debt is and what's happening with the interest rates and all that. Also, I would urge all of you to look at the unfunded debt of the U.S., which is, I think, let's say $150 billion. So it's a trillion, so it's five times the national debt. So that number is increasing by the second, too. And that is even more critical than the national debt figure, although most people don't understand it. But I agree with you. If we understood what the benefits were and we could accomplish those benefits, those are two big risks, then to me, it's a no-brainer, go decision. But I haven't been elected to go make policy, so all I can do is talk about it on the space show.
Oh, I mean, when you just look at the reasons that were given for not going ahead with Constellation, and yet any minor crisis, we can fund several times that amount of money on the spur of the moment. Whether it be a lot excess of illegal aliens crossing the border, or a hurricane, or a tornado, we can do it. But there's a motivation because people's lives are involved. Here, it's a space program, and you know how that goes. Everybody likes the space program, but they don't really want to spend any money on it, or something.
Or they don't understand it. Anything else, John? Or I'll move on because we're already at the top of the hour. I'll see if some other people want to call and talk with Dr. Juris.
I guess we can move on then.
Nothing else on your part?
I think that'll be it for tonight.
Thank you for your call.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye bye. Listeners, the line is clear. We'll stay on and see if you would like to talk with Dr. Juris. 1-866-687-7223. Email is drspace, drspace at thespaceshow.com. I'd love to hear from some of you who totally disagree with everything Dr. Juris is saying. I would certainly like to hear from some of you who totally disagree with this back-of-the-envelope type of quick and dirty budgetary economic analysis that Dr. Juris put out and I've been supporting and elaborating on. We would certainly like to hear from you before the show ended. Marshall sent in an email to me and said, here's the video I was talking about. Okay, so Marshall, I will put your foundation video that from the Von Braun thing into the archives of the show. And I probably will also post it on the blog, although the blog page already exists for this show. If you want to upload it and post it to the blog, that's fine, but I'll also put it in the summary when I write the summary later on. So thank you very much for sending that in. I have an email from Carla in Denver, Colorado. And Carla says, do you believe that the enthusiasm that seems to be existing in the new space or the new commercial sector is powerful enough to grow this new sector of the economy so that it really does become someday in the near future an economic force in our economics in this country? Or is it more or less a fanboy club, as one of the frequent guests on your show likes to refer to space advocates? And you know who he's referring to, who Carla's a woman, who Carla's referring to there. You know who uses the term fanboy all the time.
Club.
Yeah, he uses the term fanboy all the time. I don't think I want to say his name, but...
Well, I tend to agree that it's more of a fan club than anything else. That is the space advocacy community. If the if our society decides to do it, do something meaningful in terms of human spaceflight, it will make that decision eventually in its own way and go on from there. Right now, there are powerful arguments that are being made to spend those resources elsewhere rather than on human spaceflight. And personally, I think that's a mistake, but that's the reality that we're dealing with. And I would really love to make a few comments about the Gateway.
Okay.
As part of this. The Gateway is basically a space station, kind of like ISS, except in orbit around the moon instead of in orbit around the Earth. The space station that's in orbit around the Earth, the ISS, has cost somewhere in the neighborhood of $1 trillion altogether for its construction and maintenance. It is around the Earth so that in an emergency, people could get back to a safe environment in a few hours from the station. And in fact, they keep a lifeboat-type capsule available for the crew on the station. Now, some years ago, I asked how long the life support system on the space station would last without continuous maintenance. And I was told by a person in a position to know that the ISS would become uninhabitable within about a month without continuous maintenance of the life support system. We have to do a lot better than that before we can go to Mars or put a permanent habitation on the surface of the moon or the Gateway. And if it costs around $1 trillion for ISS, what kind of cost do you think would be associated with building the Gateway? And the Gateway is not even planned to be occupied continuously as is ISS right now. It would be occupied temporarily with crews that would come and go. The Gateway would be in a very eccentric orbit around the moon, so you would not be able to just leave the Gateway and go to the moon anytime you wanted, or go from the moon back to the Gateway anytime you wanted. It would be constrained by the orbital position of the Gateway in this extremely eccentric orbit around the moon. So there'd be some real timing issues there. So it's one of these little things that's, it'd be nice to have some kind of a station in orbit around the moon, but I'm not convinced the Gateway is going to add that much to the utility of exploring the moon.
So, as John Hunt would say, if he is still on the show, it is better to have a program using the Gateway, despite its characteristics that lots of us don't like, than to have no program at all, because NASA believes the Gateway is essential, and without the Gateway, there's no program. So would you go as far as that and say it's better to have this crappy Gateway and to have a lunar program than to risk not having any program at all if the Gateway didn't exist?
Oh, my attitude is take whatever you can get in terms of human spaceflight, but I'm very dissatisfied with the pace of development of human spaceflight.
I have another question for you. Bob, and Bob is in Des Moines. And he says, David, I'm using email. I hope you don't mind. Dr. Juris, my question is kind of several parts. One is the actual need to separate out the space part of the Air Force mission and have a space force. And the second part of that, do we really have any reason to either fear or be concerned about China and what they're doing in space, either with their new commercial industry that is starting to develop, especially with launchers, and their lunar plans, which are widely talked about in the One China policy? Should we be concerned? Many people blow it off and say no concerns at all, we're much more advanced than them. We don't have to worry about it. And others, especially guests that David has had on the show, are concerned about it. So your take on China and the Space Force?
Well, I'll take the Space Force first. I'm a proponent of a separate Space Force, not just a core analogous to the Army Air Corps during the World War II era, but a separate force like the U.S. Air Force became after the Second World War. So that's my position. I think it's important for a variety of reasons, including the fact that there's no real career path for high-level flag officers in the United States Air Force if they're in the space part of it right now. So having a separate space force would allow a career path to go all the way up to the level of the Joint Chiefs. And so I think it would be helpful to have that and break out the space component from the United States Air Force. The Air Force is dominated by pilots, and the Space Force suffers as a result. So that's my opinion on the Space Force. With respect to China, it's a matter not just of where a country is competitively at any given time, but the rate of change of their competitiveness is also an issue. So if the Chinese are behind the United States in terms of space launch capacity and things like that, that can change if their pace of development is more rapid than ours. They do not have the same kinds of political constraints that the United States has in developing space technology. Whether that works to their advantage in the long term remains to be seen. But as I mentioned earlier, they're going to have some pressures on their agricultural systems in the next year or two that are very significant, and that may affect their ability to go forward. I don't know. And I don't know enough about how their economy works to even opine on that. So I hope I answered your questions adequately.
Well, you did. Let's see if some listeners want to send in an email or give us a call about what you're saying. But you do have another caller on hold. So let's see who's calling you right now. Hi, caller. Welcome to the Space Show tonight. Who are you? Where are you? Thank you for calling.
Hi, this is Kim in Mexico.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm good. You know, I had this idea of what to ask about, and then, you know, I'm hearing a lot of other much more controversial stuff. But I wanted to ask John this because I feel like he's somebody who can answer, and so I want to take advantage of that. The Strato launch flew once, and there's been things in the news lately that maybe that'll be the only flight, and nobody really knows what's going to happen with it. And I never knew what to make of it, and I just wanted to take this opportunity because I thought that John might be someone who would actually have an idea. If this was really a good idea, or if it was always sort of something that was a little bit out there.
Well, that goes back to the whole air launch concept of, gee, you know, a rocket burns so much fuel getting into space in the first, you know, dozen yards or 2 miles or whatever distance you want to use, just getting up out of the Earth's dense atmosphere. But air launch has its own set of problems, and in fact, David, along with Dr. Sam Dinkin and I, wrote a paper some years ago about relative costs of launching rockets. And air launch came out to have significant disadvantages. One is if you launch the rocket horizontally, you know, like a cruise missile off of an airplane, you're limited in the size of the rocket. by the payload capacity of the plane. And for our baseline, we use the Antonov 225, which is a really, really big airplane with a huge payload capacity. And it was not enough to make any meaningful heavy launch system through the air launch concept. Second thing is you launch horizontally, so the rocket has to be dropped from an aircraft, and it then has to light or ignite its propulsion system, accelerate ahead of the carrier aircraft, and then climb up in front of the carrier aircraft. And in that pitching up, it's exposed to a lot of heavy forces that you don't have if you launch a rocket vertically and get it out of dense atmosphere and then gradually tip it over to the east and accelerate up to orbital speed. The other thing is that with air launch, you don't get that much of a velocity boost or reduction in total energy that's necessary to go to orbit, because you still have to accelerate up to orbital speed. And so you can drop a rocket that's going, let's say for the sake of discussion, 500 miles an hour in a carrier aircraft and have to run it up to somewhere around 18,000 miles an hour to get it into orbit. So you still have to accelerate it a great deal, and that takes a large amount of propellant to do that. And so you still have that. You have the issues of launching it horizontally and then pitching it up and all the additional strain on the structure in doing that. And to withstand that strain, you have to increase the mass of the rocket, the structural mass, and so on. And so and you're limited by the payload capacity of the plane and the rocket equation, if you will, in terms of how big of a rocket you can launch from an aircraft and what its payload capacity might be. The most successful air launch system that I'm aware of is the Pegasus system that the Orbital Sciences, which is now part of Northrop Grumman, I believe, was launching from earlier a B-52 and then later Lockheed L-1011. And I believe that had a payload capacity of somewhere around 1,000 pounds to orbit. And so it wasn't that large. The payload capacity is a function of the gross weight of the rocket itself. It was actually not as efficient as, say, a Delta II.
Mm-hmm.
So given all that, I think air launch is a very limited concept, unless you're only interested in launching relatively small payloads into space. One advantage it does give you is you don't have to worry about a specific launch site, and that you could, at least in principle, take your vehicle out over the ocean somewhere and drop the rocket and light it off. And that's the other thing. You drop the rocket and then ignite it. And if you have any kind of an ignition failure or mechanical problem on the rocket that precludes your lighting it at the time you do the drop, you're going to lose the vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if it's sitting on the pad and you have a problem come up at 2 seconds before ignition, you can stop everything and figure out what's going on and then deal with it.
Kim, did you listen to the Alan Boyle Hotel Mars show about Strata Launch last week?
Oh, no, I didn't, actually. I almost never listen to Hotel Mars because I'm not usually interested in the short format, but I will.
Let me just briefly summarize it, because Alan Boyle's been reporting on all of this. So when Paul Allen died, his sister is the executor of the estate and the trustee. And his sister, I think her name is Rosie or something like that, said that there are two...
Jody,
yeah. There are two parameters for Paul Allen's estate. And that Strata Launch doesn't fit either of the parameters. One is the charitable part on a humanitarian global scale, and I forget what the other one was. And it falls in between, so therefore they're going to get rid of it. So they are planning to sell it. So they decided to fly it one time and then put it up for sale with all of its intellectual property. So the asking price was $400 million with the intellectual property, and they thought there would be two really good candidates to buy it. One was Richard Branson for his Virgin operation, not the tourism one, but for the Launcher One, and Branson said he'd buy it for $1. Okay. And the other one was Orbital ATK, or Northrop, as John is talking about, because they had Pegasus, and they've not even bothered to reply about it yet. The smart thinking is that it will follow the path of the Spruce Goose and end up in Paul Allen's museum, which you're going to go see when you go to the
the SSI conference.
The SSI conference up near Seattle, and that's probably where the smart thinking is, that's where it will be, because there's no market potential for it. And the reason there's no market potential for it is the small dedicated launchers that we have been covering on the space show are taking off, like Rocket Labs in New Zealand. They've been to orbit a couple of times, and you've got Vector, and we've had the head of Vector on the show, and there's a couple of other ones. And so the need for the kind of market that this would have is not exciting anybody, especially for the costs that are involved. And they don't think they're going to get a buyer at probably any price that the family would sell it for. So the smart money says it's the modern day Spruce Goose on its way to a museum.
Yeah, it sort of felt that way to me too. And I suspect a lot of what John was saying makes it a lot clearer. You know, yet another billionaire in piling into the space arena, though. Well, we've lost one, but there's several, and it's striking. So I don't know if this fits into your discussion of the economics of it, because you seem to be having a little wet blanket party about it today. But that's, you know, that is, that's the entire other face of it, and the one that is just becoming more and more necessary to fall in line with.
I might also interject. I've been to Paul Allen's museum up at Payne Field, which is a little north of Seattle, a number of times. It's a nice museum, but I don't see any place in that museum where they could put something the size of that vehicle.
Well, yeah, actually, I thought that too, yeah.
They'd probably have to make something, but Alan Boyle prophesized. I mean, there's no documentary data to verify any of this. He just said, in response to John Batchelor, that he thought smart money would say, yeah, I'm probably going to end up going to the museum, and what better museum than Paul Allen's museum? So that's how Alan Boyle came up with that idea. There's no data or agreements or anything to support that, and there's nothing from Jody that anybody knows about to say that's what we're going to do. It's been left at that they want to try to sell it with intellectual property for $400 million.
Well, it may end up in a museum, and maybe a different museum than the Paul Allen Museum. Because, like I say, up at Payne Field, the way that's laid out and the buildings that his museum occupy, I just don't see where there's a place for them to put something that size on display. I really don't.
Well, Kim, when you go see it, see if you can figure out with your design capabilities where to house the Stratolaunch and give us a report back on the space show.
Yeah, I wonder where in the development of that vehicle they realized that they were committed to something that now had too much competition and that just wasn't going to be able to. Because I imagine that they realized that themselves by the time it was starting to get close to completion.
I don't know. I Mike Griffin was initially part of that, and when he was on the show, when he was part of that, he always said he couldn't talk about it because of NDA. And I have tried to get Mike back on the show, but now he says he can't come back on the show, which, by the way, is the same excuse that Scott Pace gives me why he can't come on the show, and that's because they're working for the government, and they're restricted on what they can say, and they're not going to come on an open mic kind of freewheeling radio show. But they could go to an NSS conference and make a talk that's highly controlled and approved, but they won't just do a freewheeling 90-minute, 60-minute interview. And I actually understand that. I don't have a problem with it at all. But when he was asked to talk about Stratolaunch, when he was an active consultant with it, he always said, NDA, I can't talk about it. So I've never gotten anybody to really talk about what they were doing with Stratolaunch, the market potential, any of the kind of questions I would have liked to have asked. Or the scaled composite people, they're the ones who have built it. And that's also why Alan Boyle thinks that Northrop would be a good buyer for it, because they own scaled composites.
Mm.
What else was on your mind other than Stratolaunch?
Oh, well, I started making little noises about private investment versus government control, and it's not a very well-formed thought, so maybe it doesn't go anywhere. But, you know, if you're talking about debt, I mean, while the government is going more and more in debt, you've got more and more billionaires up there, and a surprising number of them are interested in space. So, yeah, I don't know if you have to, I mean, maybe you just have to wait for them to really undertake human spaceflight, and that's all there is to it.
So outweigh the government so the billionaires can actually do it.
Well, it might take a while, but it just seems the way things are going, you know, they're not going to go broke. I mean, even if the government went broke, they wouldn't grow broke.
I think the only way they would go broke is if somehow their assets got seized, and I don't see that happening. But, John, what about that? No matter how long it might take, could the eventually down the road, a decade, 2 decades, the billionaires fund a real humans to the moon program and a development program?
They could. Right now they're concentrating on the launch associated issues, but eventually they're going to have to start dealing with the human factors issues. And from what I've seen, they're not dealing with those in any meaningful way as of yet. And that's something that is going to have to be addressed, and the relative risks are going to have to be retired, depending on what they want to do in space. And it may be that it all turns into a private enterprise thing in 50 years. I don't know.
Well, if Musk really wants to go to Mars with this big rocket and people, and to do it privately and not through the government, he's going to have to address the human factors.
Yes, he is, in one way or another, and whether that's by carrying a centrifuge in that rocket and a centrifuge on a habitat on Mars or not, living underground in lava tubes or wherever to shield from the radiation. I mean, there are ways of dealing with those issues. Whether they're practical or not remains to be seen, and that's before you get into the issues associated with colonization that we talked about earlier in the show.
So, Kim, I would say you're right. I wouldn't disagree with anything you're saying. And if we wait long enough, possibly the global billionaires, I think we could look beyond the borders of the United States for billionaire participation in this, could possibly do it. But I also think another factor would be what emerges out of international and U.S. plus other government regulations regarding human spaceflight beyond low Earth orbit, going to the moon, going to Mars. I think right now, of course, it's all pretty much unregulated and no man's land, but I do think we're going to see some type of regulatory environment for human spaceflight beyond low Earth orbit, and that could influence what the billionaires do and the timeline for them doing it. And I would have no idea how to forecast that one way or the other. I think it's a government risk is a risk that you would consider if you're doing a business plan. but I wouldn't know how to quantify that risk. I just think it will happen, but I don't know what it will look like. But I think you're right. I think if we wait long enough, Kim, and you're still around, you're young, you might see the billionaires doing it. The Billionaires Boys Club and Girls Club might be on the moon. And I hope I'm around to see it.
Yeah, you know, I'd love to talk more about colonization, but it's a hard thing to be clear about because there is so much that's not known. And anyhow, I've been taking up a while and see if somebody else calls in or sends an email, I guess.
Okay, but always worthwhile. Thank you very much for your call.
My pleasure.
Have a good one.
Good show.
Thank you. Listeners, Kim has vacated the line, and there's still time if we ended up doing a 90-minute show anyway. There's still time if you want to get in and get your licks with Dr. Juris. Come on, call in and disagree with him or disagree with something I've said. Make sparks fly. It's much more fun to have a heated debate. Where are all of you people? Not everyone out there listening has to agree. I guess I could throw out an end-of-the-show topic, John, that is going to throw you for a loop and everybody else out there for a loop except John Hunt, so you know what's coming. But maybe someone will call in and fight with you about something and we'll have an animated conclusion to the show. Your take on the Navy, Hornet, Lincoln, and Nimitz carrier tic-tac UFO films and sightings, the feature of the History Channel show called Unidentified, the To the Stars Academy, intelligence officers who have resigned their intelligence posts to find out what's flying with unbelievable characteristics in our atmosphere. Are they a threat to the United States or not? Your take on all of this. I know you're up on it because we talk about it all the time and you see the emails from John Hunt and I don't talk to John Hunt about it as much on the phone as I do to you. But is the Navy stuff BS? Are we being led down the typical UFO conspiracy crap path? Or could this really be disclosure time? I mean, remember Podesta, who is part of all of this, was going to tell all about the UFOs if only we would have elected his candidate for president, Hillary, and that was part of the campaign promise to elect Hillary. And Podesta is involved in all of this tic-tac Harry Reid Senate investigation that spent, what, $25 million or something like that on it during the last years of Harry Reid in the Senate. Your take?
Well, that was a campaign promise, and
I
don't
know.
Take that seriously. With respect to the Nimitz and subsequent reports of seeing strange things in the sky, if those things that were seen were not some kind of an optical phenomenon or some sort of a visual phenomenon or something along those lines, but if they were physical objects and flew with the characteristics that were described, you know, incredible accelerations and changes in speed and so on and so forth, then I don't think they are a direct threat to the United States, but I do think that they are not terrestrial. In other words, it's not some secret Chinese vehicle or some secret Russian vehicle or some secret U.S. Air Force vehicle spoofing the Navy or anything like that, because those characteristics are so in flight, if they're reported correctly and are real, are so far beyond any flight capability that anybody on this planet has that there's something else. Now, whether they are real as opposed to some kind of an optical phenomenon, I don't know. That's something that's interesting to consider, because I remember a number of UFO reports back half a century ago were actually from spotlights shining on clouds and moving. You know, the spot just by shifting a light on the ground. And so that happened a number of times back in the 1950s. As far as other rumors of debris or hostile engagements with vehicles from somewhere else, until I see hard evidence of that sort of thing, that's all speculation in my mind.
Do you believe the intelligence officers, because of their backgrounds and their track records and their credentials, which are real? I mean, they really did hold these positions and these levels and all of that. Does that make it credible, or could we be being manipulated and misled even today?
The latter, I suspect. Well, part of the job description of those people is to spread disinformation at the appropriate times and in the appropriate ways. Now, who's to say that they have forgotten all of those skills that they demonstrated so ably now that they're no longer in the service?
So one listener to the show who exchanged emails with us early on, I don't want to say his name because I don't know if he would be comfortable with that, but he suggested the items were holographic projections, which I've seen on TV shows from the 80s. And the $6 Million Man had a holographic projection of a Japanese Zero fighter against a new American fighter jet that was being tested in the desert. Of course, that's a TV with special effects, but holographic production. So maybe what the guys are looking at in the F-18 doesn't even exist, but they think it exists.
That could be the case. It's an interesting idea. I don't know enough about current holographic technology to render any kind of an opinion on whether that's likely or not, but certainly some kind of an optical projection could demonstrate rapid changes in position because all you're doing is moving light, which is easy to do very rapidly.
I would think.
I don't know.
I would think that if we're developing a new weapon and it's secret and we're testing it, that the flight characteristics, as you say, are probably beyond anything that we can do. But I don't think it would be beyond our capability to develop holographic projection in the sky as a weapon that would be beyond our capability. And they could be testing it on Hornet pilots, and only a few people might know about it. But that could become a combat weapon where the enemy fighters or bombers are coming in, and the next thing is they see, you know, all of these aircraft coming in or missiles or something coming in, and they start, you know, maneuvering, firing weapons, doing things, and yet none of them are real. So I could see us having that kind of technology and developing it, which is why I keep saying I want to see debris. I don't care about all the memos and all the other stuff that exists to be supportive of this. There needs to be something hard out there that one can see. Otherwise, why not a holographic projection weapon?
Well, perhaps. I don't know exactly how you would do it or have any kind of an idea of how you'd do it, but it certainly seems more feasible than some kind of a physical object, you know, accelerating it at hundreds of G's and changing position that way, the way the objects are reported to do.
You have a caller. Yeah. I wonder if it's, you know, who. go ahead, and then I'll put the call through.
Well, the other part of it is with debris, it would seem weird. Let's assume that this is ET, you know, extraterrestrial in origin. If anybody can travel from one star system to our solar system, they must be really lousy at planetary flight if they're crashing all the time once they get here.
Well, we're getting
along the crash by hostile action on the part of some Air Force pilot with hot guns. That, to me, is a very, very, very risky thing to do, to shoot at something that represents that kind of technology.
Maybe they're drones, and they're easy to knock down because they don't represent the mothership technology. Let's see who's calling, because one could let their imagination go wild and have a great time with all of this. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you, and where are you? Thank you for calling.
You guessed. It's me again.
Yes, of course. We're going to quit naming you SLS John, and we're going to call you UFO John. So,
well, okay. Let's just point out that this is not purely optical. Remember, what they're looking at, well, it is definitely electromagnetic radiation. This is a FLIR system, so it's infrared, and the system was locked onto the target. That means that the computer system behind it, it wasn't the human failure or human failing that did it. The actual system locked on it. Second of all, the reason why they were up there is the Aegis radar was also tracking it, and they claimed, although we don't have any direct evidence for it, they also saw it at times on their own aircraft radar. So we got really, plus the eyeball, human eyeball, the pilot. So we got multiple phenomenology track on this thing. You know, so I think it's real, and like you said, like what John's already said, if it is real, it's obviously beyond the ability of anybody on Earth to make something like that. At least they, unless there's this hidden civilization that they sometimes talk about in the conspiracy world, but I don't buy that either. That's just my thought. Now, the other thing is, if it was a test of our own system at this point, wouldn't it make sense to rope these guys in and say, okay, guys, we can't tell you anything more because it's secret, but yes, it was a test, so just calm down and quit talking about it. And also, remember, the Nimitz was, like, 15 years ago, so if we've,
Yeah, but the other one was just about 3 years ago, the Lincoln.
And it's the same sort of thing. And let's face it, the same stories go back way beyond this 70 years ago, so at least, so...
Oh, yeah.
Nothing new here. I mean, in that sense, it's just this is the first time we had this kind of data recording of it and got it released.
Do you believe these people that have spent their entire careers spreading disinformation, and they're really good at it? I guarantee you we could sit in a room and couldn't tell whether they're BSing us or not. There's no way that we could do that. Do you believe them? Like when Elizondo, or however you pronounce his name, says, I would never lie to the American people. We're lied to every day by people in government and associated with government. Who doesn't lie to the people of this country? So, and what he's saying, he said on the History Channel, I've spent my life doing disinformation and lying, but that's to our enemy and a foreign power. I would never, ever lie to the American people. You buy that?
Not in that sense, but let's put it this way. What I do buy is this. If this is a government disinformation effort, it goes 180 degrees against the entire government disinformation effort of the last 70 years. And one would question, why would they change policy all of a sudden to go 180 degrees off and try to convince people, hey, these things are real? And not only are they real, it ain't going to help the defense budget any because they're so capable, there's nothing we could develop that would counter them. I just don't think that makes any sense. So that's why I don't accept that theory.
Well, did you see the last History Channel thing where he talked about playing games with the Russians and the Chinese, and they developed an entire ET language for memos that got intercepted and translated by a computer and all sorts of things to convince the Russians that there were ETs at these different Air Force bases, so they would convince the Russians especially to deploy to these bases to spy and espionage so they could check on what resources they had to check on this, and the whole thing was a ruse. I mean, you had to see that. So why wouldn't they do the same thing with To the Stars Academy and this TV show and all of these press releases? This is made to order for them.
Well, okay, but but remember, that got going for a variety of reasons, including this guy, Burke Feldowitz, that was monitoring the activities on Kirtland Air Force Base.
Right.
Okay. Look, there's a lot of disinformation going on, and we could get off on that. But I just think in this case, it doesn't look like that's what this... Now, what I do think is, if you want to say a little disinformation, what they are doing is something else. And what they're doing is, this whole idea of the threat that they're playing, in my opinion, is basically a way to give credibility to the subject. What they're doing is, if they say, hey, these are ET things without proof, immediately they get ridiculed. They're another UFO nut. So what you do is say, we don't know what they are. All we know is they're here, they have these capabilities, they're messing with our fleet and our aircraft, and we ought to know what it is and we ought to take it seriously. So what do you guys think? And they're going, can you say we shouldn't take it seriously? So without bringing ET into it, we don't know that. Maybe it's something Russian, maybe it's Chinese, who knows? You see, that gets a focus that people have to pay attention to it in Congress and so forth. Of course, we all know it's really ET because probably from their classified knowledge, they probably have actual proof, but they can't say that because it's classified, you know?
So where do we go from here, John Hunt, because you're the less skeptic of the three of us?
Well, that's the problem. I guess it depends on... Well, how much Congress gets into it, and that's what's dubious. I think they're trying to get Congress into it.
Well, they briefed Congress on it, and they briefed President Trump on it.
And that'll be interesting. He's going to, apparently, Tucker Carlson talked to Trump about this. It's going to be on his Friday episode.
Well, but you know he's not going to say anything. Come on, any more than Jimmy Carter kept his promise to tell us what UFOs were really all about and never did it, or any of the other guys that have made a statement. He's not going to say, oh, yeah, they're real. They're out there at Area 51.
I don't think he will either. No, I think he'll probably say, you know, it's puzzling or something, and I don't know what to believe about
or,
it.
Or he may say the real collusion was with me and the Pleiades. It wasn't with the Russians, but they're so stupid they didn't pick up on the fact that it was with E.T.
Well, I'm just saying that is not pure reverence. You might want to see it. But actually, well, but here's the thing. What's pretty clear to me is that this ATEP thing that Elizondo was involved in is a creation of some senators and some interested people, which is outside of the domain of whatever's been handling the UFO issue since Roswell, practically. And so whatever that real organization is, the people that came in and took the records off of Nimitz in the helicopter and left, those guys, but that's the real UFO organization. And it's deep, it's clearly secret, and it's powerful. And so... We don't know what their opinion is. They may see these guys as... I think there's a bit of a bureaucratic struggle that's erupted inside the establishment between those that think if we ought to bring this more in the public domain so mainstream scientists can take it seriously and start researching the technologies, and those that think, no, this has got to be deep secret and it's got to stay that way. And besides that, our bureaucracy really benefits by keeping it that way, too.
Well,
that's my opinion. Now, this opinion, that's just opinion, but it's based on several years of study of this stuff very carefully and looking at, you know, things that have happened to people involved in it, you know, what the military personnel that get involved in these incidents experience after reporting it, when these suits come in and swear them to secrecy and non-disclosure. Who are these suits, you know?
I don't know, but
case after case, it's the same story.
Everybody's favorite conspiracy guy, John Brandenburg, is coming back on the show. I believe he's on the 12th. And he did an interview with another radio show, which I sent to both Johns. I forget the name of the show and the guy. But John Brandenburg, and I got three Johns that I'm talking about now. So Brandenburg says to this host, I'm just back from this highly confidential conference in D.C., and they know all about E.T. and the nukes on Mars and all of this, and I can't tell you anything about it or I'd have to kill you. You know, that's the standard line. Now, you guys heard the interview because I sent it to you, and I know you each of them listened to it. Yeah. So Brandenburg was then later in the show asked about Tic Tac, and he seemed like he didn't know what the radio host was talking about, which I thought was pretty strange. But according to Brandenburg and this conference that he attended in Washington, D.C., this would have been about 2 months ago, there was some top secret kind of classified ET conference. I mean, you guys both heard him say that.
Yeah.
And I'm intending to ask him about that. But he may tell me he can't tell us or he'd have to kill us all.
Well, if it really probably can't. That's legally it, right?
if it really existed. I mean, I tried to search for it on the Internet, and, of course, I couldn't find it. So I don't know, but it's fun to think about it and to talk about it, and I wish we had something real rather than just the fun to talk about it.
Well, that's the problem. And like I said, whether this really comes out, because like I say, I think this is one of the deep secrets. And what Brandenburg's involved in is this whole thing on Mars and the blowing, you know, his whole thing. I mean,
yeah.
I don't know what to say about that. It's a wild story.
Now, listeners, I'll say one more thing about this, and then unless either of the Johns want to say anything more, we can put it to bed. And just know that the truth is out there someplace. But a couple of listeners, unrelated to John Jurist and unrelated to John Hunt, have sent me emails as if I don't know anything about Tic Tac and this whole thing and the History Channel and the To the Stars Academy and that I've never heard of it. And they are nearly begging me to try to get, is it Elizondo? Is that his name?
Elizondo, yeah.
Elizondo. As a guest on the show. And I have turned down the attempts to do it, although I do confess about 3 months ago before the History Channel thing broke out, I did send a generic email to the info email address of To the Stars Academy to see if they'd be interested in doing a space show program, and I never got a reply from them. So listeners, those of you that have any interest in this topic at all, or would like to see if the space show address it, would you like to see Elizondo or that other intelligence officer, I forget his name, the tall, thin guy, not the cigarette man, but the tall, thin guy. What's with the gray hair? What's his name, Thomas?
Mellon?
Something? Yeah, Mellon, Christopher Mellon, isn't that his name?
Yes.
Yeah, so one of those guys, and see if they'd, you know, somewhat talk on the space show about it. So if you would like to see that as a space show program, and don't accuse me of going down and turning the program into a UFO program, because I'm not about to do that. But I think the Tic Tac case is really interesting, and I don't know what to make of it. I'm highly skeptical. I'm not as much of a true believer as John Hunt is. John Jurist is skeptical. But we do find it interesting, and we do follow it. So I'm looking for your advice, people. Should I try to get some of these people on the space show to talk openly about it, or as openly as they will, and take your questions, not just my questions? So post your comments on the blog or send me a private email if you want to be anonymous about it. Any questions more on this topic from either John?
Well, I have a couple comments.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, the first comment is I wonder if this sudden publicity is reflective of two competing lines of dispute going on within the military about whether these things should be disclosed or not disclosed, or whether there's something there or not there. I don't know the basis, but it looks like there's some kind of a conflict going on that resulted in this sudden change and release of information from the Nimitz and the other carrier on the Atlantic coast.
Yeah, the Abraham Lincoln.
A few years later, yeah. Abraham Lincoln. Now, having said that, I find that's in almost as interesting as the underlying subject matter, because it almost looks like maybe the difference is nothing more than a split between the Air Force wanting to keep things secret and the Navy wanting to get them out, for example. I don't know, but there's something weird there that's going on. Second thing is, if these things are real physical objects, and as J. John Hunt mentioned, they were picked up on Aegis radar, the air combat systems and the aircraft, and visual sightings. If they are real physical objects and display the characteristics they do, I would strongly recommend, which means nothing, that you don't go shooting at them. Because one thing you don't want to do is tick off an intelligence with those kinds of capabilities. I mean, look at how ticked off the United States got when the Iranians shot down that drone a while ago. That can lead to big problems if you go shooting at some object like that, and if worse yet, hit it.
Yeah, maybe the Nimitz would disappear.
Well, who knows? But it just seems to me incredibly stupid to go shooting at something that's that advanced, because you don't know what it'll do. I mean, if it contains an antimatter bomb, it could wipe out half a continent.
Are you optimistic that this time around we'll get an answer on this particular UFO, ET kind of thing? Will we finally get a conclusion that we can bank on, or will it just be like all the others?
I think it'll be like all the others. I think there's enough confusion out there at this point. I just don't see it that changing. There's a lot of other things that can't be really verified all that well. Like years and years and years ago, there were some rumors that missiles at Malmstrom Air Force Base, a little north of where I live, were taken offline with a UFO hovering above them and stuff like that. I just have no way of knowing how real or not real any of that is. It all seems very fuzzy.
John Hunt, any final comments from you on this topic? I have one for all of you. Why do they call it Tic Tac?
It looks sort of like a Tic Tac. I think it looks like a propane tank to me. But
what does a Tic Tac look like? You mean like Tic Tac Toe?
A candy thing, right?
It's a breath mint or something.
You mean like the little Tic Tac mints in the dispensers?
Yeah.
Okay, I for some reason didn't visualize that and see that. Okay, yeah.
I think it's more like a propane tank, but that's another question. I just say amazing. We both and other John jurors, we seem to agree quite a bit on the politics, and that's why I think it'd be good to get one of them on here. Because, I mean, I don't think they're going to expound anything too radical. They are pretty conservative, maybe. And we could maybe ask things that most of these questions would tend to not ask. I mean, we have a sensitivity to what really is going to be classified and what they're not going to talk about.
We could probably
have some good questions still they could talk about.
Yeah, but they're really skilled. There's no way we have the quality to get these guys to talk. You know, we can't pull their fingernails out or do something that these guys are so skilled beyond anything that skills we have in questioning people that the interview would be a cakewalk for them. And we wouldn't know if we're being shined on or if we're getting the truth. I mean, how would I know?
I would know.
You would know.
But at any rate, like I said, I think that it'd be interesting just to get. We don't have many people at that level. On the, you know, we've had some people higher once in a while, but most of the time not. It'd be interesting to get them under.
Well, maybe that's why they don't respond to that email I sent a couple of months ago. But
yeah.
Listeners, you tell me. I'll follow your lead. I know there's one guy out there who really wanted me to do this, and I turned him down. But so I've got, and I know John Hunt wants to do it, so this other guy out there wants it. John Juris would probably say fine. But tell me what you want, and as I said, post it on the blog or send me an anonymous or private email if you don't want to go on the record about it. But I assure you, I am not interested in turning the space show into Coast to Coast or doing a UFO thing all the time or something like that. But on the other hand, I'd love to know if there really are ETs and and UFOs, and I'd put them on the show if they were real and they could speak English. Absolutely. I'd like to be beamed up to the mothership, and they probably had the technology where I could do the show from there and not worry about crappy phone lines. So I'm all for it. I'm all in. John Hunt, anything else that you want to add?
Well, I guess we covered a lot of bit material here. I mean,
thanks for the call. Bye. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
And bye now.
John Jurist, anything that you would like to add? Any concluding comments for everything we talked about on the show tonight? Anything we omitted that you would like to share your thoughts about?
Well, I think it was fun. It seems like the viewers or listeners that you have who are motivated to call in seem to be pretty reasonable people.
Well, they didn't call in. They didn't call in on. Yeah, but they haven't called in on Tic Tac. Only John Hunt has called in about Tic Tac, and whether someone will get us before we leave the show or not, I don't know the answer to that.
But I think the discussion was wide ranging for sure. And it was a lot of fun.
Anything that we've omitted that you wanted to opine about or talk about or offer your views about?
Well, basically that I'm skeptical that we're going back to the moon by 2024. I'm skeptical that we're going back to the moon in the near term, we being the United States. I'm not so sure about China, but as I've said, they've got a lot of problems coming up, as we do, that are going to put more pressure politically on the system to spend money on other things, and some people will view that as meaning you take it away from the space budget or avoid spending additional developing a space budget. So I'm very skeptical that it's going to work out.
Real quick, when Bridenstine spoke at ISDC, there were actually several questions about making the 2024 deadline, because there's a lot of skepticism about that, given we haven't really started much of the program yet. We don't even have spacesuits for the moon, and none of them even are on the drawing board or, you know, contracts lit or anything like that. So he explained two things to us. Number one, he explained what NASA means by going back to the moon with humans by 2024. And he then explained what NASA means by having a permanent presence on the moon. So let me tell you what he said. Now, I'm not using his exact words because I did not take notes, but I know what he said. And I'm going to give you the essence of it. And I've said this before on the space show, but maybe we have different listeners tonight. So, number one, 2024, NASA will consider having met the goal of going back to the moon on 2024 if they can go down to the surface of the moon from the gateway, open the hatch, step out, put their feet on the surface of the moon, maybe spend an hour or two on the moon, and then leave and come back. That meets their goal of making it to the moon by 2024.
That sounds like Apollo 11 revisited, doesn't it?
Well, Apollo 11 was 3 days or 2 days or eight hours,
no,
I mean, or something like that.
Not on the moon.
It wasn't the, 2 hours.
The EVA of the moon was just a couple of hours, and they lit down on Sunday and left Monday afternoon.
Well, yeah, they were longer on the moon than this. Now, permanent presence on the moon. The gateway is going to enable NASA to go to the surface of the moon, any place on the surface of the moon, don't interrupt me, any time that anyone needs or wants to go to the moon. So having a permanent presence on the moon means going down to the surface of the moon from the gateway anytime you want to, anywhere on the surface you want, but then you come back to the gateway. So the permanent presence doesn't mean you have a permanent presence on the lunar surface. It means you have a permanent capability to go to the surface of the moon. However, since the gateway is only going to be occupied around 1 month in a year, I'm not sure how that jives with that Bridenstine definition, and there was no question follow-up that says, but you're only occupied for 1 month or so of the year. How does that mean you got a permanent capability to go to the moon, the lunar surface, anytime you want? But that's what they mean. So for those of you that think we're going to the moon and we're going to have a habitat there and we're going to establish a permanent capability on the lunar surface in 2024 or even later on in 2028, that is not, as Bridenstine said at ISDC, current thinking. Now, I think all of this is in development, so will it change and evolve? Absolutely, especially if we actually have a way to go to the moon. It looks like I may have just gotten an email. No, but it's something different from John Jossi, a satellite, a snapshot of the commercial satellite industry. Thank you, John, but it's not relevant to the show. So I just wanted to tell you what the thinking was in early June. I believe all of this planning is very fluid, so I wouldn't bet money that this is the final plan for either 2024 or 2028, but it is what is being thought about as of the time Mr. Bridenstine gave his talk to ISDC, which was early June. So with that, John, do you have any more comments, concluding comments, regrets for having sat on top of the mountain for 2 hours in your car?
Well, that sounds like 1984 doublespeak. If a permanent presence means, yeah, maybe 1 month out of 12 you have people on the gateway, and again, I don't believe you can go down to the lunar surface anytime you want from the gateway or back up because of the orbital characteristics of the proposed gateway.
And so to me,
it just sounds like a bunch of doublespeak.
And it's also going to take us to Mars, although when Dr. Zubrin gave his talk in the advanced propulsion section, which I heard in between his selling his book, he talked about why the gateway was in a horrible location to go to Mars, and that actually commercial chemical rockets from the Earth with refueling on the way, which he believes can be done, is far more economic and efficient as a way to get to Mars than doing anything from the gateway. So
he's probably correct in that.
Yeah, he is. And he did that on the space show, by the way, when he had his last space show visit. So Zubrin debunks that efficiency for gateway to Mars all the time. So for people interested in that, you might look up some of Dr. Zubrin's comments or his papers or even listen to his last appearance on the space show. John, I want to thank you for sticking out 2 hours with us. It's a long show without a break. And glad your cell phone held up. And there is hope for rural internet and cell phone technology yet. And
hey, if we can communicate between Earth and Jupiter or Earth and Saturn, why can't we communicate between Billings and the West Coast?
It's a $64 question. I can't really answer that. But I'm glad you did it. We'll have to do this more often. It was an enormous amount of fun for me. I hope the listeners enjoy it. It will be archived early in the morning California time. And those of you who called, those of you who emailed, thank you all very much for that. And John, thank you for that. So listeners, good night from John Juris. Good night from me. Good night from the Space Show. And everybody, keep looking up, and if you see a Tic Tac flying overhead in some unusual maneuvers, report it to the Space Show. Thank you very much. We'll give you John Hunt's reporting email and cell phone number so you can report it directly to him. He'll run the Space Show Tic Tac reporting agency. Everybody have a great night. This is the last live program until after the 4th of July, so everybody have a very happy, a very safe 4th of July. If you're traveling or playing with fireworks or doing anything, keep it sane, keep it safe, and enjoy yourself. And we, despite all of our partisan bickering, I believe we have an absolutely fabulous country. We have a great history. We've done a lot for the world, And we have a potential to do a lot more for the world, and space is just a part of that, which I hope we don't trash, and which we have an opportunity to carry on with this generation as well as future generations. So happy 4th of July from the Space Show. Keep looking up. Good night, everybody.